The East Coast cleans up after Hurricane Irene. Worries are building about a power vacuum in Libya. A tough new anti-bullying law takes effect in New Jersey. And a giant energy deal for ExxonMobil in Russia. I'm Pat Lyons with a preview of Wednesday's New York Times. In our lead article, Michael Cooper reports on the recovery and the cleanup efforts up and down the East Coast in the wake of Hurricane Irene. Private estimates put the cost of the storm at around $10 billion, and experts say that much of the damage may not be covered by insurance. A large percentage of the harm was done by flooding, not by wind, and ordinary property insurance doesn't cover floods. There is federal flood insurance, but only a minority of property owners buy it. On top of that, deductibles for wind damage have shot up in coastal areas in recent years, and many homeowners may have to pay thousands of dollars out of pocket before their coverage kicks in. Meanwhile, hard-hit areas are still coming to grips with all the highways, power lines, sewage treatment plants, and other infrastructure that will have to be repaired. And a number of towns in Vermont remain completely cut off because of washed-out roads and bridges. The Air National Guard was ferrying in emergency supplies by helicopter on Tuesday, including food, water, medicine, blankets, diapers, baby formula, and tarpaulins for damaged roofs. And doctors and nurses were being flown in from out of state to help provide emergency medical care. David Kirkpatrick reports from Tripoli about the power vacuum in the Libyan capital after the overthrow of Colonel Muammar al-Qaddafi, whose main stronghold was overrun by rebel fighters a week ago. The rebels still have no unified command, and different groups have staked out fiefdoms in different parts of Tripoli, marking their territory with spray-painted graffiti. Fighters from Zintan control the airport, he reports, while the fighters from Misrata guard the central bank and the seaport, and the Berbers from Yefran have taken control of the main square. The civilian leaders of the Transitional National Council, the closest thing the rebels have to a new government, are still in Benghazi and haven't come to Tripoli yet. And the rebels' efforts to name a military leader to unify the fighters have exposed tensions within their ranks, between tribes, between regions, and between secularists and Islamists. Though the city was remarkably quiet on Tuesday, Mr. Kirkpatrick reports that all kinds of people are roaming the city with weapons and arguments could quickly turn ugly. People realize that having guns all around is unacceptable, said one member of the council. But right now, they don't trust the regime, they trust the guys with the guns. When an earthquake devastated Haiti in January 2010, the neighboring Dominican Republic was one of the first to extend a helping hand, sending food and medicine and easing visa rules to allow Haitians to seek refuge and medical care across the border. The goodwill from the earthquake assistance raised hopes of improved relations between the two countries, which have a long history of friction. Now, though, a year and a half later, Randy Archibald reports in the Times that the goodwill has worn off, and the Dominican Republic is turning hostile to Haitians again, by deporting refugees and by turning people away at the border. Though the Dominican Republic is better off than Haiti, it's still a very poor country with 14% unemployment, and people there are blaming Haitian refugees for taking away jobs, straining services, and spreading diseases like cholera that remain a big problem in Haiti. The Dominican isn't the only country where the grace period for Haitians has run out. Aid workers say that Jamaica, the Bahamas, and the United States have resumed deporting Haitians as well. But the problem is the biggest in the Dominican, where the immigration director estimated that there are 500,000 Haitian refugees and illegal immigrants. Nobody can stand up to an invasion of that nature, he said. Winnie Hu reports in the Times on a new anti-bullying law taking effect in New Jersey that some are calling the toughest in the nation. Schools across the state are putting all kinds of new anti-bullying measures in place to comply with the law. In East Hanover, students can phone the police Crime Stoppers phone line with anonymous tips about their classmates. Children as young as kindergarten age in Elizabeth will spend class time this year learning the difference between telling and tattling. And at North Hunterdon High School, students will be told that there's no such thing as an innocent bystander when it comes to bullying. If they see something, they have a duty to say something. Supporters of the law say the spread of social media like Facebook and Twitter have made bullying among kids an even bigger problem, requiring tougher measures. But some school officials say the state's gone overboard, and there's no way the schools can be expected to police their students' lives 24 hours a day, especially in an era of steep budget cuts. The Arctic waters of Alaska may be mostly off-limits for oil drilling, but not so in Russia, where ExxonMobil won a coveted prize on Tuesday, a deal to explore for oil and gas offshore in a vast stretch of the Russian Arctic. ExxonMobil expects to invest tens of billions of dollars in the project, along with Rosneft, the Russian state oil company. And the two companies may eventually spend half a trillion dollars in all, Andrew Kramer writes from Moscow. Russia has been a tricky place for Western oil companies to do business. Shell got squeezed out of a big project in Sakhalin Island in 2006 after it spent $20 billion there, and BP thought it had a deal 6 months ago with Rosneft that the Exxon deal now seems to supersede. One important feature of the new deal, Exxon is giving Rosneft some stakes in assets elsewhere, including the United States. The deal will almost certainly have to be reviewed in Washington, where past deals for foreign stakes in American oil assets have often been met with scowls. Finally, a new concern for reporters who will be covering the presidential campaign, that they themselves will become the story. Jeremy Peters writes that preparing journalists for the campaign trail these days is an exercise in indiscretion management, with political operatives, partisan bloggers, and even other journalists watching for a chance to pounce. At a training session for young political reporters from the National Journal and CBS News, a veteran correspondent warned that now that everyone has a flip cam, they're looking to get you. An offhand comment, a tweet sent in haste, an unguarded moment playing beer pong in a bar, all of these things have already been turned into career-threatening embarrassments for political writers, Mr. Peters notes. And political campaigns are more and more willing to discredit and disparage journalists who don't swallow their spin. As Ron Fournier, the editor of the National Journal, told Mr. Peters, these days, everything you say can and will be used against you. And that's a preview of the front page of Wednesday's New York Times. For more on these and other stories, pick up a copy of the paper or visit nytimes.com. From the New York Times newsroom, I'm Pat Lyons.